The problem is everyone abuses me and treats me with contempt. I'm stricken by disease and very sick. On top of that, a demon's in my head. I take on all the suffering of beings, completely free of all discouragement. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So breathing in whatever suffering we may have of all of those possibilities and all the infinite possibilities of how we could be suffering, whatever suffering or distress or pain we have right now, let's just breathe that in. Thinking that we're taking it away from ourselves and releasing it into vast, empty, limitless space. Breathing out to ourselves. Happiness, relief, whatever's needed. Breathing in our own current, past, hypothetical future suffering. Just accepting and taking it all in. Releasing it. Breathing out the antidote. Now breathing in the suffering of anyone in the human or animal realm or any realm who has lost everything, has lost their job, their bank account, the shirt off their back, really suffering. We're going to breathe that in, releasing them from it and releasing that suffering into vast, limitless space. Breathing out whatever is needed. Maybe we can't restore the things they've lost, but we can breathe out whatever happiness and relief there is. Breathing in also the suffering of anyone who is being treated badly. Anyone who made a mistake on Twitter and is feeling the wrath of the universe. Anyone being scapegoated. Children in school being bullied. Anyone being mistreated in any way. Gymnasts. Breathing it in, releasing it, and sending out whatever they need to feel okay. Breathing in the suffering of anyone who is sick, from a minor cold to the terror of a bad flu to cancer or anything else that could go wrong with our health. Disability. Any kind of pain. Breathing out, healing and relief. Acceptance, peace of mind. Breathing in, mental illness, moodiness, short temper, any kind of negative or demonic influence that can throw us off balance. Breathing it in for all sentient beings who are suffering in that way. Breathing out peace of mind. Healing, acceptance of how everything's on. Help if they need help. Never getting discouraged, but always breathing in whatever suffering there is. Even if it never seems to diminish, we continue to breathe it in. And breathe out happiness from our Buddha nature, with its inexhaustible store of happiness, peace, joy, healing, and so forth. And now breathing in whatever kind of suffering all sentient beings have in the human realm, the hell realms, the gods realms, their future suffering, animal realms, the hungry ghosts. No suffering too big or small for us to breathe in, receive, dissolve, release into the ether and breathe out happiness, peace, awakening. And now thinking that all sentient beings are completely free from suffering, including ourselves, completely filled with every kind of happiness, and completely awakened. And letting go of all of our visualization, all of our thoughts, all of our intentions, and just resting again, bringing ourselves back to that state of resting in our own nature. And now letting go of even that, although not letting go completely, because we can rest in our own nature even as we are chanting our verses and studying our texts. Have a sip of water or stretch. Next up, we're going to share the screen. I forgot to set up early, so we'll just do that quickly. There we go. So we'll chant the 37 practices. We'll chant today's practice 3 times. Again, we're in a state of very open awareness, very relaxed but alert state of mind. We're going to see if we can remain in touch with that as we chant these verses and process with great attention the meaning of each one. First, the 7 preliminaries, which are ongoing practices. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat, to navigate samsara's endless sea, and set myself and other beings free, for that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. All those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire. When I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To leave behind my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my Dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in Dharma dawns and thrives. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness, a guest, will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stayed. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I'm with friends who strengthen the 3 poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade, kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims. Not following the friends who harm my practice, This is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane. Constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Who can the worldly deities protect, themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail? The three jewels which embody freedom's path, reliable protection without fail. To seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And now the three levels of motivation for Dharma practice. We need all of them, but they tend to build one on the other, culminating in the Mahayana practice of wishing to free all beings from suffering. But first we have to free ourselves. The sufferings of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. We strive in all our efforts just for that. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. My mother is each and every sentient being, since time without beginning cared for me. How can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free, to cultivate the mind of full awakening. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. And this verse 10 is the beginning of the bodhisattva path. It's working not only to free ourselves from suffering, but to free ourselves from samsara. And now it becomes bodhicitta when our aspiration is to free all beings from samsara. And the rest is how to. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone. While focusing on others' benefit gives rise to Buddhahood awakening. Because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness for others' suffering, this is the way bodhisattva trains. And now bodhisattva boot camp, applying verse 11 to everything that can go wrong in our lives. If someone driven by intense desire steals all my wealth or instigates the theft, to dedicate to them from all three times my wealth, good deeds, and merit, everything, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Though I've not done the slightest thing that's wrong, without a cause someone cuts off my head, to generate compassion in my heart and take upon myself all their misdeeds, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone slanders me and spreads the word, maligning me throughout the universe, to pay them back, I fill my heart with love, extolling their good traits and character. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone tells a crowd my hidden faults and speaks of me with undisguised contempt, to see them as my spiritual friend and bow sincerely with respect to them, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone I've cared for as my own child turns on me as their worst enemy, then like a mother when her child is ill, to shower them with more love than before, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Just if someone my inferior or peer through pride disparages and puts me down, to honor them as I would my teacher and place them reverently on my crown, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And now today's verse, verse 18, when everything goes wrong, and we'll talk about that. We'll do it three times. When I've lost everything and everyone abuses me and treats me with contempt, I'm stricken by disease and very sick. On top of that, a demon's in my head to take on all the sufferings of beings completely free of all discouragement. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I've lost everything and everyone abuses me and treats me with contempt, I'm stricken by disease and very sick. On top of that, a demon's in my head to take on all the suffering of beings completely free of all discouragement. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I've lost everything and everyone abuses me and treats me with contempt, I'm stricken by disease and very sick. On top of that, a demon's in my head. To take on all the suffering of beings completely free of all discouragement, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So we're all back. Does anybody have any questions or comments before we plunge into verse 18? John Renish, I'm unmuting. Oh, okay.
I was hoping you can clear something up. In verse 5, we talked about three poisons. Verse 18 in the reading, I'm seeing that they're talking about five poisons. So is three a subset of five, I'm assuming, but which and what are they?
Right. So the three main poisons, so the main framework is the three poisons. So we start from ignorance. Ignorance is the first poison. I'm just going to mute you. Ignorance is the first poison, and everything else springs from that. And we've talked about, actually, I guess we talked about it more on Sunday at KDC about the wisdom paramita. But ignorance is basically a dualistic view of things, thinking we're separate from everybody else. Everything else that goes wrong for us springs from there. And so the two primary other poisons are, we can relate to our situation to like things being other than us in two different ways. And one is desire, like we want them, attachment, we want this. And the other is anger or hostility or aggression. So that's the three basic poisons. And that's the primary set. But there's a couple of subsidiary ones. And they're actually expressed in different ways sometimes. Jealousy is always one. And that it's related, like jealousy is not separate from, jealousy is actually a combination of both. It's desire for something and anger that you didn't get it, somebody else got it. So the subsidiary poisons are a little bit of a mixture of the three main poisons. So jealousy is one and pride is often the other one. Probably most commonly pride is the other one. But sometimes it's greed as opposed to just attachment. Greed is like really, really intense attachment, I guess, and wanting things. And then the other one that can sometimes be one of the five, so now we're up to six, and the other one is called doubt. It's like when you're just not sure. But when they say doubt, when in Tibetan Buddhism, when they say doubt, what they mean is vacillation. They mean uncertainty, like that you don't know if the Dharma is true or not true. So you can't really get going. But I would say that if you just want five, I would go with jealousy and pride on top of ignorance, attachment, and aversion. Okay, anything further, John? Okay, anybody else have anything they would like to clear up? Yes, Deidre, I'm unmuting you.
Is that list, the verses that we just chanted, is that on the blog somewhere? I can't seem to find it, just the one that you're sharing on screen.
Yeah, it's not on the blog. I could put it there, but it's just going to get buried because I don't have a way to pin it. I mean, I probably should look into this. I don't have a way to pin it somewhere, to pin a file. Like, I wish I could do that, and I should really research that. I'm going to make myself a little note. Thank you. But that's the document that I email. I emailed you the most recent version a couple of weeks ago, and I can just email it again.
No, that's okay. It's just the trying to find, like, a sheet I can print out that's, like, the one that you just recited from.
Yeah, this is it's the one that I email everybody. So I emailed it a couple of weeks ago to the whole class.
Oh, okay.
And so I'll email it again. I'll attach it again.
Oh, okay, thank you. All right, thank you.
Great, and it'll get us through next week, verse 19, until I have to do a couple more translations. But I'm doing it in pieces because 18 and 19 are their own thing. Like we just had Bodhisattva Boot Camp, and so we're launching now. Does anybody have anything they'd like to say before? Before we get going. So we're still in Bodhisattva boot camp for another verse, really, but the bad stuff stops with verse 18. And so verse 11 was taking and sending. That's what we do whenever anything happens to us that's described in any of the boot camp verses. So we always go to taking and sending. And if you have Ken McLeod's commentary, he always includes like a how to apply taking and sending in this situation. So that's our basic tool, verse 11 of Action Bodhicitta. And 12 through 17, which we completed last week, verse 17, are about things that happen to us through some other individual person harming us. You know, they steal our stuff, or they slander us, or they humiliate us in various ways, or they just turn on us with ingratitude when we've been kind to them. And so there's a specific remedy for each of those kind of situations. And they're by no means exhaustive. People can do other things to us too. But by the time we get through those, we should have it down. Like whatever somebody does to us, we do take and sending, we remember karma. We remember they're not in control. We have a lot of remedies we can apply. So we've just gotten practice in applying our Bodhisattva toolbox in six different specific situations. So verse 18 takes off like from that, and it's not about somebody harming us specifically, although that can be part of it. It's just about everything going wrong. It's about when bad things happen to good people or bad people. But we think they're all good people, really, because of Buddha nature. Like, everybody's Buddha nature is good. So we try to focus on that in people when bad things happen. And so verse 18 just takes it to an extreme. They obviously didn't throw in every possible thing that could happen that's bad. But for somebody, say, in 14th century Tibet, with a very simple life, like no technology, maybe no neighbors, like it's, you know, it's really a pretty good compendium of what can go wrong in your basic life. Oh, I see Dan has retreated to the outdoors now. Looks good. So let's look at that. Right, so what's going wrong in verse 18? I've lost everything. So somebody stole all our stuff, but there's other ways we can lose everything. You know, we could lose our job, we could lose our significant other, we could lose someone through death or illness, or they don't like us anymore, whatever, just we lost everything. So everything is everything. Whatever you can think of you could lose, it's happened. So we're imagining ourselves in this situation. Like, so he's given us a lot of practice, like with specific situations, and now he's just throwing it all on top of us and saying, how do you apply it now? Like, what's the worst case situation? What do you do now? So he's just really reinforcing this point that we should maintain our bodhicitta no matter what happens to us. No matter how much suffering we have, we're always willing to take on everybody else's. So anyway, we've lost everything and everybody hates us. We're the one who said some stupid thing on Twitter and it got retweeted. Is that what you call it? Retweeted like a billion times, and even people in, like, you know, Germany and Africa and, you know, the Antarctic, like everybody who has Twitter is like piling on us. Everybody hates us. We cannot walk out our front door. We've been doxxed. We have to stay in our house. Like, it's that bad. We just imagine it's bad as it could be. We're sick. We're really sick. Like, we're just really, really sick. It's, you know, not only are we stricken by disease, but we're really sick. That's what the Tibetan says. Not only physically sick, but our mind is not working well either. It's like stricken by a demon or possessed by a demon in the Tibetan. And if you look at all the different translations, it means like in Tibet, it literally means a demon. Like, they really believe, like, if you're mentally imbalanced or in a really bad mood, you're dealing with a demon. We tend to think of it as mental illness, or at the, like, sort of not so serious extreme, it could just be moodiness, like ever get up on the wrong side of the bed. Well, we got up on the wrong side of the bed and, you know, we're feeling a bit, not to make light of mental illness, but we're just feeling very extreme emotionally, which when it's really extreme could be schizophrenia, bipolar, you know, borderline personality disorder, whatever it is that we're dealing with, all of this. We're just a mess. Well, it's the worst possible mess, and we have nothing and no one on our side. So what do we do? And the answer is verse 11. We always go back to verse 11. So that's a good one to have memorized. But we're going to see what Dingo Chensi has to say. We're going to bring in Dingo Chensi, Ken McLeod a little bit, and Pema Chidron is back. She actually sat out the last few verses because, you know, I'm working for her point of view. I'm working off my notes from a seminar she gave at Omega Institute that I live streamed a couple of years ago on this text. And she spends a lot of time when she gives a seminar. She spends a lot of time taking questions, so she ends up not having time to do some of the verses. So that's why she hasn't been seen for a while, but she has a very nice commentary on verse 18. So, Dingo Chensi Ramjain, again, anybody have anything that they wish to share or ask before we look at that? Yes, Joanne, I'm going to unmute you.
I know this is probably the where I should not interject. I should have done it earlier, but in the refuge prayer, mm-hmm. you mentioned virtues. I'm seeking some teachings on the paramitas. Perhaps those paramitas will give us more, I guess, thrust behind these practices.
Indeed, and they're coming up.
Okay.
I forget the exact numbers. It's like verses, there might be 30 through 35 or something like that. But the paramitas are coming up in this text. This text covers it all.
Great.
But you can also, if you have the Ornament of Precious Liberation, also known as the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, it has a lengthy chapter on each paramita. Path to Buddhahood by Ringu Tulku covers them more concisely. Almost any text if you have, I mean, I'm not recommending you go out and get all these things, but almost any basic Buddhist text you have will address the paramitas, and it's a very excellent thing to become more familiar with. And you could Google it, and you might get a teaching by Sitio Rinpoche. He has a nice teaching that I think is out there in cyberspace.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Yes, paramitas are going to, we're sort of dealing with the negative situations now where we're experiencing suffering, and then we're going to talk the next few verses after we get completely out of Bodhisattva boot camp going to be about ultimate bodhicitta, the nature of mind. But that's just a couple of verses, and then we go into the paramitas from there.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for bringing that in. Anybody else have anything? All right, then we're going to look. We're not going to read all of Dingo Chensi. Everybody will have read that by now, hopefully once or twice or three times. I love the way he starts this chapter, though. And we're going to unpack it a little bit because it turns out to unpack into three specific things we can do. So first thing, countless people, this is page 128 if you're reading along. Countless people in this world are deprived of everything, food, clothing, shelter, affection. They can hardly keep themselves alive. Many people are victims of ill treatment or are stricken by serious illness. So one thing he's bringing into focus here, and I think it's kind of a natural thing for us to do. We probably already do this. When we're beset by adversity, we sometimes, and it can really help to think that we're not the only one. Other people may have the same kind of suffering as us, and they may even have it worse. You know, it's like if you are hungry and you can't get lunch, you think of people starving in China, as our parents' generation used to say to us. You can always think, you think of homeless people when you're, you know, not happy with your house. You know, I wish I had another bathroom, which I sometimes do. Thank God there are people who don't even have basic shelter. So he's encouraging us to turn our mind in that direction. But then we take it a step further with taking and sending. So he says, when you yourself suffer such torments, wish with compassion and courage, here's the taking and sending, to take the difficulties and anguish of all beings upon yourself and to give them whatever happiness you may have. So if you think of homeless people, you could give them your house with only one bathroom, which to them would be like this fabulous, amazing, wonderful, warm, sheltered palace. So it can be that specific, you know. We think people are sick, people have cancer, like they're not going to get better. People have terminal illnesses, they're not going to get better. You can take on their illness and try to relieve them, you know, just think that we're relieving them of it and send them our help. So he's encouraging us to think vividly of what kinds of suffering we're having. Suffering, what does that look like for other people? And I can say from experience with myself and from working with other people who are having intense kinds of suffering, it really helps just to open up their perspective that much to think, oh, right, there are like millions of other people who have this kind of illness, or, you know, whatever the problem is, who have lost their job, whatever our problem is. So that's step one, is that we think of others who are suffering. When we're suffering, we think of others who are suffering, and we take their suffering on ourselves and send them happiness. So step two, and, you know, that took most of the paragraph. There's one sentence each for the other two steps, but I see them as three steps. Step two is try to provide others with whatever they need in reality. So we not only do taking and sending, but we do helping people. I know Joanne, for example, does a lot of volunteer work. I imagine other people here do similar things. I know that in Washington, D.C., they do some work with the homeless, have done some work with the homeless and collect food, right? You guys collect food for people who need food. We do whatever we can for people. And I was particularly interested, like, it's sort of obvious, like, if you don't have food, there's organizations, for example, in ways, like, we can donate food to the food pantry, or we can, there's just support organizations that feed hungry people. If they don't have clothing, well, we can give clothing to Goodwill, that we're not using anymore, I guess, or we can, you know, I know, like, my brother was homeless for a few years in Washington, D.C., and Amazon has a program. There's a place called Miriam's Kitchen, which is a sort of a refuge for homeless people in D.C., and my brother went there a lot, I eventually found out. And they had a thing with Amazon where they had a list of things that they needed at any particular time. And so you could go follow their link to Amazon and order, like, socks, like six pairs of socks or whatever was needed. So food, clothing, shelter, Habitat for Humanity, supporting homeless shelters, whatever we do. But affection is, like, an interesting one, I think. So he's talking here about people who are deprived of affection. And so who would that be? And I wrote about this in my class notes, if you haven't already read them. But from my mom having been, you know, in an institution for people with dementia, I know how lonely people are. I mean, my mom was lonely even though I was there a lot and we hired people to come in. She never remembered. Like, once the person was gone, she didn't remember anybody had ever visited her ever. So one time I showed up to an event that they were having and met this person, this young person who was volunteering to read to some of the residents. And I was introduced and they were like, "You're here? You're in Richmond?" And I'm like, "Yeah." All they'd heard from my mother was that I never, ever visited. She hadn't seen me in years. So they were quite shocked. But anyway, so assisted living and, you know, just old people in general, your elderly neighbor who lives alone, people in any kind of institutions. There's like programs where you can mentor children in school who either need help with basic academic skills, or, you know, organizations like Big Brother and Big Sister, like kids who need help with social things because they don't have a parent. There are a lot of people who are deprived of affection, could feel like us sometimes. So we know what to do with that, obviously. But I was really interested that he brought that piece of it in. And I think that was like, wasn't that, Andy, I'll get to you in just a sec. Wasn't that Mother Teresa's original motivation, that she saw all these very sick people, you know, homeless, sick, nobody taking care of them, and she wanted them to feel cared for? She wanted to make people feel cared for. I thought that was quite lovely. So I'm unmuting Andy now.
As far as people being deprived of, I'm thinking about this and about my experience with people and with myself. I think everyone feels that. And I wonder if at the deepest level, the feeling of being deprived of affection is some kind of glimpse of the real situation that we're in,
Which
is that we don't have a personal self and that we're going to suffer no matter what. And that no affection really can assuage that. So I feel like we're always hungry for it.
Yeah.
Even those of us who have all the outward trappings of it.
Yeah. Yeah, you can be very lonely in a crowd, as they say, or in, you know, the midst of your family Thanksgiving or whatever. Very good. Andy, by the way, you're a psychotherapist. That's
yeah. Your
psychotherapy. So you've seen, you've seen a lot of people suffering in various ways.
Yeah. And the thing I came to also is that suffering has no essence.
Right. Often we're dealing with people who don't know that, as I'm sure you're completely aware. So, you know, but I think you're bringing up is kind of an existential, you know, observation. And you know, Lamanorla Rinpoche and other teachers have said this a lot. You're alone in the bardo. Like, nobody can go with you when you die. So it is a description of our actual state. And I think it's interesting that you bring in the idea of selflessness. I think selflessness is almost the antidote for that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like not having a self that needs, you know, to have company. But all is very interestingly intertwined. So thanks for bringing that to the fore. Do you have anything further that you wanted to say about it? Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Joanne, you are unmuted now.
Okay, when I visit assisted living facilities as part of my ministry, I think what I'm trying to share or give them is an affirmation of their precious human existence. They are still very precious,
yeah.
No matter how their bodies are depleted.
Yeah,
I think that's my mission, I gather, but please clarify if I'm not, I don't have the, you know, my perspective should be different.
No, that's lovely. That's quite lovely. I think that's what lonely people are looking for, is that somebody sees them and somebody thinks that they have some value. Somebody thinks they're precious. And you can do that in intensive ways, like Joanne goes into assisted living facilities and works with people there as a volunteer. But like just smiling at your neighbor, you know,
exactly.
or inviting them over for a cup of tea. I mean, even if you can't go that far, just smiling at them, waving at them, sending them some kind of positive, you know, signal, I think can make such a huge difference. And I know for myself, if I've been in a low mood, I'm not usually in a low mood, but it can happen. Somebody being nice to me makes such a huge difference. Suddenly just the whole thing is turned around. Somebody smiled at you. Somebody noticed that you were there and they thought you were worth smiling at. So I think we want to like not underestimate our power, even if we can't get out and do like all kinds of volunteer work and get people off the streets and off drugs and all the, and feed them and everything they need. We can do little things. And one thing that I have found really helpful, unexpectedly helpful, it's been driven home a few times, is when somebody is screwing something up and you're patient with them, they notice. And one time it happened in a situation that I was so thankful that I had been patient, because when I lived in New Hampshire, Lamanorla Rinpoche came and taught there every year. And so it had been like a long time since he had visited, but I was in a store and like a drugstore, and this woman just could not, she was completely messing things up, and it was like taking like 15 minutes and there were people behind me, and I was definitely getting a little bit impatient internally, but I just was nice to her. And I might have said something snippy, it could happen, but I didn't. And as she was finally ringing me up and it was all set, she said, "Oh, you were with that llama." And I was like, God, if I had like exploded at her or something, it would have looked so bad. Like I was associated with this llama, and then suddenly, you know, the whole thing looks like, well, you know, what's the use? These people are just as impatient as anybody else. So anyway, that's my little sermonette on helping people. So that's step two. Step one, always taking and sending. Always team other, like get off team I. Even if you can only do it for a second at a time, get off team I, like, oh, woe is me, even if it really is. And think team other, like other people are suffering like this too. I will do taking and sending for them. Step two, see what you can do in the world to relieve somebody's suffering. And step three, reflect on the positive qualities of suffering. So I put that on the blog as a contemplation with a little musical accompaniment. You click on the link. So let's think about that. If you haven't read ahead, if you have read ahead, please feel free to say, but can we think of ways in which suffering is beneficial, is helpful to us? Why? There are whole, like, dohas, or maybe they're not dohas because those are really nature of mind, but there's whole texts, like, and excerpts and whatever, verses written on, like, why we would rather have suffering. Some of them are quoted here by Dingo Chenzen Rinpoche. Why he'd rather have suffering. Don't give me happiness. Give me suffering. I'm a Dharma practitioner. So we're just providing a moment for everybody to think, like, why should I be, like, grateful when I'm suffering? And that speaks, actually, now that I'm saying it, to mind training, like the 7 points of mind training. One of the most famous verses, be grateful to everyone. Drive all blames into one and be grateful to everyone, like even our tormentors. Why should we be grateful for suffering? So I'll just read what Dingo Chenzi has to say. Suffering, in fact, can be helpful in many ways. It spurs your motivation. I think that's the big one. And Geshe Jampa Tekchuk also points that out. Like if we are totally, we talked about that last week with the God's realms, like the God's realms, everything's going well. Like why would you want to wake up? And then suddenly you find yourself unable to cope when your time in the God's realm is over. You have no tools. You have not developed any way to deal with the kind of suffering you're looking at ahead of you. When things are going well, we don't tend to practice so much. We don't have the same motivation. If we have a good practice set up, a daily practice, then we probably do it. But it's really suffering that motivates us. Yes, oh yes, Dharma will help me now. Like nothing else will help me, but Dharma will help me. So he says, it spurs your motivation. And as many teachings point out, without suffering, there would be no determination to be free of samsara, because why would we feel like we needed to? It's all good, right? He goes on to say, sadness is an effective antidote to arrogance. So Valerie's not here because she lost her internet connection today, sadly. And she said her phone wasn't up to joining us that way. So she was asking about pride and arrogance last week. Sadness is an effective antidote to arrogance. So when things are going badly for us, if you're that person in the verse, when I've lost everything and everyone abuses me and treats me with contempt, I'm stricken by disease and very sick, on top of that, demons in my head, you're not going to be feeling proud at that moment. It's going to really push down your pride. So he quotes Patro Rinpoche, I don't like happiness, I like suffering. We all know Patro Rinpoche, right? The like 19th century wandering monk who wrote Words of My Perfect Teacher. I don't like happiness, I like suffering. If I am happy, the five poisons increase. That's what John was asking about. If I suffer, my bad karma is exhausted. So that's another, like, Dingo Chenzi doesn't enumerate them for us. He just says it motivates us to practice. But here's number two. Number two and number three. If everything's going along well, we tend to indulge more in our emotional reactivity. We're not, feeling the repercussions of it because everything is going well. So we let things build up. That's the not practicing part. But also, when we suffer, our past bad karma is exhausted. It burns off our karmic debt. And we've seen that in several of the boot camp verses, the reminder, always remember karma. Like this is happening to you because you have the karma for it. Was somebody waving? Oh, Kathy, you've unmuted yourself and I'm not even noticing.
I just did it. I understand this, but it seems to me that I have spent a great deal of time in my practice over the years not going to extremes in either direction. Mm-hmm. To, when things are going good, to not, get things are great, everything's great. Then, stick to the middle way. And this, this is kind of striking me as, like the suffering, kind of really throwing yourself into it. And I don't know, I just wanted to say that.
Yes, yes, so what you're talking about is equanimity, and I'll get to you in a second, Angela. It's equanimity. It's like, and Lamanar Lumpche has often given us this advice. When things are really good, don't get carried away by it. Don't get too attached.
Or when things are really bad.
Right, or when things are really bad. And that's not what this is talking about. And it's either Dingo Chense or Geshe Jampa Tekchok says this doesn't mean we pursue suffering.
Right.
We don't pursue suffering. You don't have to create suffering for yourself. It will come soon enough.
Yeah.
So we're not, this is an antidote. Like, this is a bit of an extreme, you know, Tibetan Buddhism often expresses things in extreme ways.
Right.
In an extreme way. It's like, he probably doesn't really love suffering, but he's saying that for our benefit.
Yeah.
He's not thrown by suffering. He's like you. He's got equanimity. It's like, okay, now I'll work with this.
Right.
I'll work with the good thing. I'll work with the bad thing. But for people who are not motivated to practice when things are going well, for them, this is like, just bring it on. Bring it on, because it purifies our karma, our emotional reactions in check, and so forth. All right, I'm going to go
to...
What?
You can mute me.
I'm going to do that. You are now muted, and Angela is unmuted.
Point to bring it up about suffering, because, you know, like today I was even stressed out when I was working for a client, and because I couldn't find a figure, I was doing some tax accounting for them, and it wasn't working out, and the whole thing wasn't working out on the spreadsheet, and I was having to redo all the work. And then when he sat down to try to find something else, I was doing taking and sending, because I had recognized, I just projected the stress out onto him because I couldn't find it, and this was wrong, and his stuff that was supposed to be working, and I was like, no, you shouldn't do that. And so when he sat down for another different situation, I was practicing taking and sending, and so I wasn't giving him stress. I was giving him like calm and saying everything's cool, I'm going to take care of this. You just see him calm down.
Yeah.
You just see that suffering and have it just so that you can give it to other people. Even if you don't go looking for it, you're surrounded by it all the time.
Yeah. I think you and Kathy have brought in a really important point that the way that we can help others is to model equanimity, and that's really what taking and sending is. It's equanimity, because our reaction to suffering tends to be to want to get away from it. Like, we take it really seriously. Like, I don't want this. I'm not happy that I'm sick. I don't want to be sick. And on and on. So we're reversing that and taking it on. We don't really want to suffer. We don't really want to be sick. What we want to do is, by activating the other extreme, we're bringing ourselves more towards the middle, which is what Kathy was describing and Angela was describing, of equanimity. So by connecting with, like, the acceptance of the suffering, like, give me even more suffering, you're nullifying, let's say, the power of that suffering to hurt you, and you're bringing yourself out of being preoccupied with it. And at the same time, you're getting in touch with, you're connecting with the happiness that's always there, even if it's the happiness that you're alive today. You know, maybe you're sick, but you're alive, like a lot of people aren't. Maybe you're sick, but the sun is shining out there, or even if it's not, maybe you like rain. You know, there's always, you know, you just open up your perspective. So taking and sending, that's how taking and sending functions mechanically, I think. Is it opens our perspective, but also helps bring us back towards equanimity by reminding us of the other extreme of happiness. So anybody have any other comments before we continue on? We have about 20 minutes left. All right, we're going to read a little bit more Dingo Chense, and then we're going to go on to a little bit from Ken McLeod, because he brings in a really important point, and then Pema Chidren has the topper. Pacho Rinpoche continues. I don't value high positions. I like low ones. If I am important, my pride and jealousy increase. So when we're feeling like we're not the success we wanted to be, we can take that in a very constructive way. Like, if I really were this hugely successful, famous person, I would have a lot of pride. And the next verse is going to talk about that. So at least I'm not cultivating the poison of pride when things are going badly for me. If I am lowly, I relax and my spiritual practice grows. The lowest place is the seat of the saints of the past. And Karat Gongchung, Karat Gongchung is like, if you read the footnote on this one, he's that guy that is quoted, like his story is told a lot by the older traditional teachers. He's the guy who lived in the cave, the practitioner who lived in the cave long, long ago in a galaxy far away. And every time he'd go out of his cave, his whatever he was wearing, his robe would snag on a thorny bush. And he'd always get irritated by it and think, when I come back, I'm going to cut that bush. But when he got back from collecting his firewood or whatever he had to do, he would go, no, I can't waste a moment. I have to practice Dharma. And he wouldn't trim the bush. So the next time he would come out, he'd go through the same thing. He never trimmed the bush because his practice was too like important. He was remembering his precious human existence and impermanence. And it's like, no, I must get to my Dharma practice. I can't waste time on the bush. So this is Karat Gongchung, who's being quoted here, who says, difficulties are our spiritual teachers. We've heard that many times. Obstacles are a spur to Dharma practice. Suffering is a broom to sweep away our evil deeds. Do not regard them with dislike. So it doesn't mean we have to pursue them or love them. We just don't want to be repelled by them. It's like, okay, now it's suffering. How can I turn this into, the Dharma path? So he says, and this is Dingo Chensi again, it is indeed when difficult times and circumstances arise that the difference between genuine practice and its mere semblance is revealed. So how we react when these bad things happen to us is a measure of our progress on the path. If we can maintain a certain amount of equanimity, we're doing well. We're on the right track. If we totally lose it, and get totally self-pitying and so forth, then it shows us we have some more work to do and we have plenty of instruction for doing it. And I'm just going to read this one more paragraph. There are negative spirits who thirst to take life. The best way to stop them from harming you and others is not to combat them with anger, but to satisfy them by repeatedly making visualized offerings of your body. So this is the second time in the 37 practices commentary when Dingo Chensi has reminded us of practices like the Chö practice. And I've promised to do a session for people who have the Chö empowerment, and I'm going to be in touch about that very soon. But so Chö is like an extreme example of how to practice taking and sending, or how to be a bodhisattva. And he goes on with some actually really nice stories. So if you haven't read the commentary yet, please read about the five Rakshasas, ogre-like beings who live on flesh and blood, because that is a lovely story. But for now, we're going to look for a minute at Tim McLeod because we only have 15 minutes left. And he brings in a point that I think is so important. But I'm going to read him from the beginning. I'm just going to read a few paragraphs. So he starts out saying, you believe, and maybe we do, maybe we don't. We're pretty savvy practitioners by now, I think, those of us who are here. You believe that practice will make your life better or at least less painful. Would that this were true. At any moment, you could lose your partner, your child, your parent, or close friend through accident, flood, earthquake, or violence. A fall, a stroke, a genetic defect, or an unknown pollutant can suddenly leave you disabled or disfigured. Your work, your livelihood, can vanish with the flick of a pen. The phone rings. Your life has completely changed out from under you. He says, do you think your practice can prevent any of these from happening? Well, we know as practitioners that it doesn't, like bad stuff still happens. So, and that's what, Tomei Zangpo is describing for us, like the worst of the worst, everything bad piling on. But Ken reminds us of an important point. He says, be honest, anything can drive you crazy. A selfish sibling, a car that does not start, an unexpected traffic jam, an overbearing boss, a blank screen on your computer. I'm like, that's me. It's like, a hormonal imbalance. I'm assuming he's talking about men and women here. It does not take much. And I think I've mentioned before my love for a set of books that was written like in the 1980s. Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. I don't know if other people read those, but the beginning, and I've told the story before, but I'm going to tell it again. in the introduction to it, they talk about why they wrote the first book, which then was only going to be one book, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, because somebody asked them to describe Americans in two words. And they, the words they came up with were easily bothered. Americans, you know, I don't know that it's less true in other countries, but I think countries that have real problems, you know, we often joke, like we're upset about something and we say first world problem. Well, there are places in the world that have so much suffering that they don't care, like if it's raining, you know, or some little thing is foiling our plans. But so we want to be aware of that. Like, it doesn't have to be like as extreme a situation as describing verse 18. It could be little things like stub my toe. You know, I'm having such a bad day. I stubbed my toe and my email wouldn't work. And, you know, and I don't know, there's all kinds of things. I can't think of the list right now, but we know, like all the little things that bug us. We can practice equanimity on those. We don't even need to lose our job. So Ken goes on to say, adversity is part of life. You cannot predict it. You cannot prevent it. You cannot control it. That reminds me of that, like the 12-step thing. You didn't create it. You didn't, I can't remember, you can't stop it and you can't control it, something like that. Those are really important to remember because that's one of the ways that we get so off kilter when bad things happen is we rack our brains, like what could I have done differently if I just hadn't done that? Like the whole concept of insurance, which I'm grateful for insurance, but the whole idea is you should never actually have to suffer adverse consequences or loss no matter what happens to you. We have flood insurance, we have fire insurance, we have car insurance. We have, you know, insurance so if somebody falls in front of our house, we don't have to pay anything. But adversity is part of life. We can't escape it. So whether it's big or whether it's small, we want to remember to apply taking and sending, remember karma, etc. Team other. And so he says, when you feel that your life is hopelessly bad and you cannot see how it is going to improve, can you sit in your misery and wish that through your suffering and struggles, all sentient beings are freed from theirs? And then he says one more thing that I quote in my blog. He goes through like he has now, if you have the book, he has the description of how to apply taking and sending in this, like just recall a time when you felt like this and here's how you do taking and sending. And then he says, at some point, if we keep doing this practice, if we really apply this practice, at some point, in a few minutes, in a few days, in a few years, no one can say when, I kind of assume it's going to be down the road, something changes through our practice. What changes is not your situation, not your pain, not your misery, and not your confusion. You still have all of those things to deal with. You just stop struggling against them, and that makes all the difference. And that's what taking and sending is about. It's about not struggling against pain and adversity, but breathing it in. And then remembering all the happiness that you have that you could send out. So I'm going to read what Pema Chodron has to say. Did anybody have anything that they wanted to say before I do that? All right. Pema Chodron, reading from my own notes. So here's what she has to say about verse 18, and she brings in a really, really important point that somebody would have brought up and has been brought up in the past. She says, down and out, hard luck. Maybe this is the fifth year of hard luck, bad karma ripening again and again. Don't lose heart. When it gets too bad, it becomes hilarious. Sense of humor is another tool in the Bodhisattva toolbox. That's more for us. And we don't laugh at somebody else's misfortune. We are only allowed to laugh at our own misfortune. But if we can retain a little bit of a sense of humor, no matter how, and I've known people who were dying of cancer who could see the humor in some, you know, stupid aspect of their suffering or whatever. If you can do that, it will never overwhelm you. So it's not bodhicitta per se, but it's more like life is a dream. You can't have a sense of humor if you take life too solidly. So having a sense of humor about whatever it is, whether it's as small as the computer not working or as big as you're dying, if you can have a little bit of a sense of humor, you're not invested. You're going to be okay. You're going to be able to let go of everything when the time comes. So, but I just love that. When it gets too bad, it becomes hilarious. So true, if only we can see it. So, but she has a couple of good stories to tell too, very briefly. It's only one paragraph. The advice in these verses is tonglen, taking and sending, based on the sitting practice of learning to feel what you feel, being conscious and aware of what's happening in your body and mind. Taking and sending is just another practice for self-awareness. We recognize that we're affected by somebody's suffering. We recognize that there is happiness and joy somewhere deep down in the mix, and we have access to it. She says, based on that, you take the pain of being desperately ill, the fear that you will die. So then she tells the story of a, and I didn't obviously write the whole story down, but just the gist of it. Story of a strong person, a physically strong person that she knew, who became very disabled. And his story didn't fit him anymore. It was so painful to his self-image. I mean, imagine if you haven't, some of us have been through that kind of thing. We become disabled or we're diagnosed with an illness that takes over our life for a period of time. And we're not the person we were anymore. We can't do the things we're used to doing. And it's very upsetting initially. Or it can be very upsetting initially. I think for most of us it is. So he became very disabled. His story didn't fit him anymore. It was so painful to his self-image. Gradually, over 6 months, nothing changed except how he related to it. He now does tonglen, or taking and sending, all the time to connect himself with other people. Not pushing away his pain or shame or rage, he's willing to feel them without speaking or acting out of them, but using them as a basis for compassion. And going from unconscious is where you're just reactive to things. Like you think somebody's, you know, insulting you and you just lash out at them. Going from unconscious to conscious, where we instead can step back and think, why is that person acting that way? Oh, because they're suffering. And developing a kind heart rather than a hard heart. We can develop a hard heart when we just think people are trying to hurt us. We feel put upon. We think nobody's ever suffered. One of my mother's favorite lines, nobody's ever suffered the way I suffered. And it was genuine suffering. Disabled people were in the indifferent category or even aversion for him before. Now he feels this tremendous empathy and love and care. It's changed completely how he feels about himself and what it means to be an embodied human being. So that, just through the practice of taking and sending and having Pema Chodron for a friend perhaps to help him, help coach him through it, it completely transformed his outlook on himself and on life and on others. And then so this is just one sentence. She probably told it a little longer. She's a story of previously homeless person who used homelessness as a path of awakening. Not so much about hunger, because there were kind people who helped him find food, but fear. So when he was homeless, he was experiencing a lot of fear. And so he's taking and sending to take in the fear of others and send out, you know, fearlessness and so forth. And presumably that transformed him too. I don't have a note on that, but I guess that's why she's telling it. And then she says, she sums it up by saying, tonglen, taking and sending, opens up your world. Instead of your comfort zone getting smaller and smaller, the area in which you can move with an open heart and mind begins to expand. The ability to be in tougher and tougher situations without closing down. And closing down is when we're very enmeshed in our own suffering and we're maybe lashing out at others, or we're just feeling miserable and, you know, we can't get out of it. So what we get from this practice is to not shut down, or if we do shut down, to not stay in it for long. Because if we're trained, once we've encountered these teachings, eventually we're going to remember, I could do taking and sending. Like, I'm going to be miserable anyway. Might as well try taking and sending. So she says, which do you choose? Meaning the shutting down or the opening up. And we don't always have a choice in the moment. Sometimes we do shut down, and there's no shame in that. But as Dharma practitioners, we're always looking to recognize that moment when we can choose something different, as Pema Chodron puts it. Like, I could do taking and sending instead of feeling sorry for myself. Joanne, did you have something?
Author of that piece that you just read.
I'm sorry?
The author, the writer.
That's Pema Chodron.
Oh, it is Pema.
Yeah, it's from a seminar she gave, so there's no book on it so far. I assume there will be someday. It's a commentary on the 37 practices. I just happened to be able to live stream it. I'm really grateful that I did. Anybody have anything else? We have a couple of minutes left. All right, if nobody has a comment, I'm going to talk a little bit about, first of all, I'll just email people about that, but I've talked about offering a meditation class, like a 4-session meditation class for anybody who wants to. Oh, Mark has a question. Sorry, Mark. What's your, I'm unmuting you. All right.
Okay. I was just wondering, I was wondering if Tonglen, when you were talking about kind of using Tonglen to reach something more deep in your being, or I'm wondering if Tonglen isn't sort of a way of accessing your naturally compassionate life being that's already there in you.
Yeah, definitely. It's a way of accessing our Buddha nature.
Right. Okay.
Equanimity, as Kathy was sharing, our Buddha nature. We think of Tonglen as a way to take away people's suffering and send them happiness.
Yeah.
But really, it's all about us. And Team Other is all about working with ourselves, too. Like, what we can do for other people is often very limited. So we're really working with ourselves, our own reactions, our own compassion. And compassion and wisdom are part of our Buddha nature. We have them already, but they can be quite covered up. So yeah. we're uncovering ourselves by doing taking and sending.
All right, thanks.
Sure, thanks for that comment. Anybody else? So I will email about this, but just to give you a preview, it's going to be a 4-session meditation class. I'm accepting input as to when would be a good time. I'm thinking I'm only going to do one class a month. This will be we'll have one class about an hour, could run a little bit longer. And each of the 4 classes, we're going to go over a particular meditation method, like to really clarify like what we're doing here. And there will be a requirement, which obviously I can't enforce, so it's the honor system, but you have to meditate for 15 minutes a day. To get anything out of this class, you got to do practice at home on a daily basis. And I'm only asking for 15 minutes, more is fine. And it has to be on the cushion or the chair. It's not like great if you can meditate while driving and walking, but I want you to learn to sit on the chair or the cushion for 15 minutes every day and using the specific technique. And we're going to really go deeply into the basic techniques of Shime, like the 4. It'll include, the first one will be sensory perception. The second will be breathing second, but we'll figure it out. And the third will be open awareness. And then the fourth will be Tonglen. So we're going to do kind of an intensive on each of these kinds of meditation to help each of us, and I still work on this myself, each of us develop a habit of practice, a discipline and habit and routine of practice daily. That when we sit down, it's not like, okay, now what am I going to do? Am I going to chant the verses or am I going to, you know, follow my breath? Like there's so many things I could do. Sometimes like, it totally paralyzes us to practice. So we're gonna talk about that. So I'm gonna email people and let me know if there's a time that works for you. Dan, I'm probably gonna offer the same thing in Richmond. We're gonna talk about that at our meeting on Saturday, and that'll probably be Sunday evening thing, although it could be a different time if people's time frame has changed. So anyway, I'll email about that with some details and then people can give me feedback and then I will set up the time to do it and you can come or not come. And if you know other people who would like to do it, you're welcome to invite them. I'll do it by Zoom. I'll probably do one in Richmond for local people and one by Zoom. All right, anybody have any questions or comments before we do our dedication? Okay, I'm finding my prayer sheet. Okay, so... everybody's all set? Okay. So we'll do the dedication. And again, as Marilyn pointed out, the last line in the second verse is not the same for all of us on our sheets. I usually, instead of saying I dedicate all virtue fully, I say I dedicate this practice fully. They're both good. Either way is fine. All right. So now, Team Other sharing all the benefit from our interactions today towards the enlightenment of all sentient beings in all the 6 realms. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults the enemy, and from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. By Beatrice. They know things in their true existence, Kuntuzang Po and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha, this dedication please fulfill. We'll just let our minds come to rest once again in our body, awareness of our body in this present moment of existence. Very open, vast, spacious awareness. With alertness and relaxation in equal balance. And I will unmute everybody to say goodbye. All right, we're all unmuted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great week. I will be emailing you, and I will see you next week.